Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our telephone talk program. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us this morning. In the first hour of the show today, we'll be spending some time talking about archaeoastronomy, and maybe a simpler way to say that is just the astronomy of ancient cultures. We know that human beings have been interested in and followed things in the skies, in the nighttime skies, and in the daytime for a long, long time. We know that because in the written record, going back as far as there is writing, people have made references to it. And we have many reasons to believe that, in fact, there was astronomy going on before there was writing. Although there to investigate what people knew and what they did maybe takes a little bit more detective work. But this morning we have with us someone who has been involved in doing this kind of work and thinking about this subject for some time now. His name is Kim Melville, and he's professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder. And we'll talk a little bit this morning about some of the projects that he's been involved in, some of the investigations, various places around the world, in this country, in India, and also in Egypt, where he was involved in investigating a site that may be the world's oldest astronomical observatory, one that is, in fact, older than Stonehenge, which is one of those places that people think of when they think of ancient astronomy. He's here visiting the campus. It was good enough to come spend some time with us. As we talk, questions are welcome. 333-9455. That's the Champaign-Urbana number. Also, we have a toll-free line. Go to anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Again, 333-WILL. That's what you get if you match the numbers and the letters. Toll-free 800-222-WILL. Thanks very much for being here.
I'm glad to be here.
How did you, I know from having looked at just a little bit on your webpage, you talk about the fact that before being involved with this, you did other kinds of astronomy and, in fact, auroral and solar physics. We just had some aurora here apparently last night.
Very nice ones, yes.
I'm really sorry to say that I missed it. In any case, that was some of the kinds of things that you were involved in before getting involved in archaeoastronomy. How did you become interested in this subject?
Well, while I was doing solar astronomy, I was always fascinated by discovering other people who were equally much in love with the sun and interested in the sun. And the sun often was the major focus of interest of ancient cultures, and so I was interested in locating evidence of other people's interest in the sun and alignments of buildings and evidence that they worshiped the sun as I worshiped the sun as a modern astronomer. I also was involved in a number of eclipse expeditions where we would go to rather remote parts of the world and wait for the sun to be covered over by the moon, and we would often arrive at these places for a month or so ahead of time and set up objects that sort of looked like cannons or guns, namely these telescopes that we would point at the sky, and then after a little while, the sun indeed would disappear. And it was always interesting to watch the response of locals to our strange behavior and the disappearance of the sun. So often in these eclipse expeditions, which were in Africa and Tahiti and Mexico and places like that, we'd be immersed in a local tradition involving the sun that was very, very much different from the Western appreciation of what the sun is, but really quite fascinating.
Yeah. I think, as I said, you know, we in the written record, we know that ancient cultures were interested in charting the movements of stars and planets, and obviously you would expect that people would be tuned into what was happening with the sun, certainly, and also to some extent with moon. So we know that that's there in the written record, and I think we have every reason to believe that going back a long, long time, even further than that, that people would have, for some reasons that were pretty easy to understand, people would be paying a lot of attention to particularly the sun and other sorts of things. But then having said that, then if you're going to some place and you're looking at a place, say, where people lived, and you're looking at the built environment, the things that they actually put there, and you're trying to answer this question, what is this place? Why is it set up the way that it is? How do you go about deciding that some place really does have some kind of astronomical significance?
It's an interesting puzzle because the easiest things to look for are orientations of stones and of buildings and of temples to the important times of the year, namely winter and summer and equinox, the solstices and the equinoxes, and so we can easily go in and look in those directions in the, on the horizon or other directions in space to see if they built any structures aligned with those positions of the sun. But those are only four times of the year: summer, winter, spring, and fall. And undoubtedly, they were paying attention to important things, things that they saw powerful and dangerous, and meaningful in the heavens that were not occurring at the equinoxes and the fall, and the solstices. So that there's a lot of stuff out there that we are missing simply because we don't know when they considered dates to be important. But it's an alignment to the sun at various times of the year that would be the first thing we'd look for. Yeah.
So that is that interest in the sun at midsummer and midwinter, is that something that you find all over the world, different places, different cultures?
Yeah, I think so. That's pretty universal. That's the obvious changing of the influence of the sun upon one's life. At winter, the sun is has gone to its lowest position in the heavens, and the sun is producing the smallest amount of light. And for some people, there is a fear that as the sun moved south, it would not turn around, but would continue on south, and that would be the end of the world. And so a number of people would organize rituals or festivals or dances or sings to remind the sun that he has a responsibility to humankind and come back. So that the turnaround position at winter solstice, December 21st, was somewhat scary, and often is the most important time for people to pay attention to the sun. At summer solstice, the sun, on the other hand, is in a sense most oppressive in terms of the heat and light that it produces, and so that is a time of maturity of the sun in which one wants to pass also, wants to have gone also.
If I think maybe if people know anything about, he would just have this passing knowledge, ever thought about ancient astronomy. I think probably the place that will come to mind is Stonehenge. But I'm interested in having you talk about this this place in the Nubian desert that you were involved in looking at that is older, and I guess there is some thought that it might be the oldest such place so far that's been found.
It is certainly the oldest place so far, but one never knows when one will discover something even older. But this is in the Western Sahara Desert, off to the west of the Nile Valley, west of Abu Simbel, just at the southern border of Egypt with the Sudan. And it's a area that was occupied beginning about 10,000 BC until 5,000 BC, at which time there was a climatic change and the desert became what people call is hyper-arid, when it was impossible to live in the sands of the desert. And during this period between 10,000 and 5,000 BC in the area, there were cattle nomadic pastoralists who would wander, who would move across the desert in search of places for water and fodder for their cattle and goats and sheep. And this one area called Nabda Playa is a basin without any drainage that would get filled during the summer monsoon with rain. And for an astonishing 5,000 years, people would keep returning to this basin beginning around June and for remaining there for several months when there was water in the lake before it had evaporated. And so year after year, century after century, millennium after millennium, people kept returning to this place until eventually, maybe 6,000 BC, They developed it into a ceremonial center and built graves for cattle. It was a pastoralist, nomadic pastoralist, for whom cattle were the most important things in their lives. They obviously had cattle worship. They had graves in which articulated skeletons of cattle were buried. They built a calendar circle at that time, which is orient, has ports in it that are oriented toward the North Pole in the sky, and to the sun at summer solstice. So there's an example of how one can identify people's interest in the heavens and in astronomy. They also, in a rather interesting, unique fashion, dragged in 2 or 3 ton megalithic stones onto the sediments of the dried lake, and set these stones in long lines, megalithic alignments, as we call it, that stretch for half of a kilometer across the lake. And when the lake would get flooded, water would lap along the base of these stones that would stand 4, 5, 10 feet high out of the sediments. And these stones are aligned with the major stars that would appear on the eastern sky on the mornings of June and July, when people had gathered on the shore of the lake. So they're aligned towards the bright star in the Big Dipper. They're aligned toward Sirius, which is the brightest star in the sky and was a very important star for Egyptians because it heralded the rise of the Nile and was a deity for the Egyptians. And it was also aligned. They also had an alignment to the three stars in the belt of Orion. So this is a rather fascinating example of the attention that these people paid to the heavens. Especially fascinating because these were not residential agriculturalists. These were just nomads who would come and go, and there was no one, there was no large settlement at all that was a year-round settlement. So just on these annual visits, they put enough effort into this area to align these stones.
Mm-hmm. So I know that there are other places where we see things that are kind of like this. Is the thinking that these were places of ritual significance as well as being essentially calendars or kind of calculating machines for you to know what time of year it was? Basically, those two functions, we think they were both of those things?
I don't think they were calculating machines as much as they were ways of honoring the heavens and the powers that resided in the heavens. I don't think they would have used them like we would use a surveyor's instrument surveyor's telescope to determine the day of the year or any kind of calendrical anything with any kind of calendrical precision. So I think these were just places for them to pay their respects and express their gratitude for the continuing cycle of the seasons, which brought water to this particular lake. Without water, life was impossible. And so there were the summer monsoon rains, which they, of course, were really concerned about returning every year. And so I think that was part of the ritual ceremony to make sure that the cycle of the seasons continued. They were there originally entirely for practical reasons, you know, and so this is a ceremonial center that had its origins in the needs of the community for their own survival, rather than a ritual or a religious celebration. And gradually, practicality turned into ritual.
Our guest this morning, this part of Focus 580, Kim Melville. He's professor. He's professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at University of Colorado at Boulder, and is here visiting the campus. He's talking with us this morning about some of the work that he has done looking at astronomy in ancient cultures. And questions are certainly welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll free 800-222-WILL. I know now that, I guess it's been some years ago, it might have been as much as 30 years ago or maybe more, when someone first looked at Stonehenge and started to talk about the alignments that are found there, and first, at least that I know, was the first person to say it wasn't set up this way by accident, that it was intentionally set up to mark or observe things like the sun at various times of year, and perhaps also positions of the moon and so forth. And I guess then there continues, though, to be some question about how actually it was used, what it really meant. And I think actually there are some people who say, well, we're not sure that was intentional on that part. As you go around, you look at places like this place in Africa or Stonehenge or other places. Can you entertain the notion that somehow this was an accident, or that it doesn't mean what we think that it means, or it wasn't really set up, that these alignments just might be there by chance?
Yeah, that's certainly always the possibility. We don't have people to talk to. We don't have any written records. And so there's a great deal of supposition on our part that these did indeed have an astronomical alignment. I think it's often hard for us to appreciate how important the night sky and the day sky were for people in the past. And we surround ourselves with walls and roofs, and we have streetlights, and we have more almost completely divorced ourselves from the idea of any powers, anything important happening in the sky. We might get hit by a comet sometime. The dinosaurs did. But we don't consider that to be part of the dialogue between ourselves and the heavens. Whereas in the past, not only did people live under a sky, but they also didn't know the sources of health and power of their own in their own cosmos. So I think people in the past probably had much greater interest in what was going on in the heavens than we do now. And so it's not at all surprising that they acknowledged that belief in power by aligning stones. The trouble with Stonehenge is that there's too many stones. And with a lot of stones, of course, you can claim that, well, given a few stones, I can always find an alignment. And hence it's been sort of sunk in a lot of controversy. There are a few astronomical alignments that are really quite clear. Namely, there is a avenue going off to the northeast, which and a so-called heel stone that the sun rises above approximately on summer solstice. But and so that seems to be a part of the astronomical astronomical features, or part of the astronomical ritual of Stonehenge. But even that is not too clear, because it's not certain that someone actually stood in the center of Stonehenge and looked out to the north to the northeast, or whether people walked in along that avenue traveling to the southwest, which would have been in the direction of the sun setting at winter solstice. So even there, even with the most clear-cut of alignments and organization of stones and Stonehenge, we don't know whether it was celebration of sunrise on summer solstice or some kind of ritual involving the setting of the dying sun on winter solstice. Speaking of the dying sun, the Stonehenge monument itself seems to be probably associated with burials and some kind of mortuary rituals in the area, and probably more so than an astronomical observatory. It was a very important burial site between maybe 2800 or 3000 BC and 1800 BC. The site in Egypt that we were just talking about is 2,000 years earlier than that, 5,000 B.C. Hmm.
We have a caller to talk with. Why don't we do that? In Belgium, Illinois, line number 4 right here. Hello.
Hello. Mm-hmm. Your discussion here so far has really talked greatly with solar-type relationships. But I've always wondered, the moon makes some very dramatic changes during the month and during the year. And do people follow the moon the way they followed the solar settings and risings in the sun and in the sky? Excuse me, the sky.
Yeah, very much so. The moon, you're right, is a very important indicator of time for many people. The moon, of course, divides the year into our 12 months, and many cultures would identify the beginning of a month by either the full moon or the new moon. And today we have in India, for example, the life of most Indians is controlled by a solar lunar calendar where the sun and the moon are used together to determine dates of times of festivals. And so a full moon or a new moon is a major event. It's hard for us, going back into the record, to identify the exact position of the moon at a particular time and to use that as an indicator that they were observing the heavens. But there are places like in Colorado, we have a place called Chimney Rock, where I've done a lot of work, and that is a place where the moon, in particular the so-called standstill cycle of the moon, was observed. The moon has on top of its 27 and 29 day cycles a 18 year cycle, and there's evidence that the Anasazi, who lived in Chimney Rock and Chaco Canyon and Mesa Verde, knew about and made records of the changing appearance of the moon on this standstill cycle.
Well, doesn't the moon every year reach a southernmost place where it rises and a northernmost place where it rises and sets?
Yes, you've got it actually absolutely right. But that those extremes, the southern and northern positions, varies throughout the year, sort of like an accordion. And there is a time called a minor standstill, when the swing between north and south is the least, and then 9.3 years later, the swing between the south and north points is greatest, so that at the time of its greatest swing, the moon does something the sun is not able to do. It rises to the north of the sun at summer solstice and to the south of the sun at winter solstice. And so that is a time which caught many people's attention, because the moon was exceeding the range of the swing of the sun.
So it would have an importance also. So it could also be involved with these celestial sights also.
Oh, very much so. And at the time of the major standstill of the moon, it also has great effects on the Earth's tides, because the moon is highest in the sky at the time of major standstill. And so for middle latitudes or northern latitudes like Scotland, for example, the moon has the greatest influence on the tides at that time. And so every 18.6 years, Isle of Lewis, for example, has huge high tides and huge low tides, so that tidal flats are exposed and people can go out and get food from the tidal flats, and then they have to be very careful not to linger too long because of the high tide that's going to come in. So there is a very, very, very dramatic practical effect of this 18.6-year cycle of the moon.
Thank you very much, sir.
All right, thanks for the call. We're at our midpoint here. I'll just quickly introduce again our guest. Kim Melville is professor of astrophysical and planetary sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder, and is visiting here, the campus, and is talking with us about some of the research and work that he's done in looking at the astronomy of ancient cultures. And your questions are welcome. 333-WILL or 9455, toll-free 800-222-WILL. We talked a little bit about the tendency of people to, as far as we know, to pay attention to the two most dramatic things in the sky, the sun and the moon. Are there also places where we know that people are interested in either planets or stars and how they move and what they do?
Well, I already mentioned the fact that there's these megalithic alignments that we discovered in the Sahara Desert to the brightest stars that the nomads could see on the mornings of summer when they were there, namely the Dubhe, which is the brightest star in the Big Dipper, and the three stars in the belt of Orion and Sirius. And Sirius, this sort of leads into Sirius. Sirius is a very serious object in the sky, and it's very, very important for the Egyptians, because during the Old Kingdom, namely 2500-2000 BC, it rose on the dawn and the eastern sky just around the time of summer solstice, at the time that the Nile would begin to rise, that snow was melting in the mountains to the south in Ethiopia, and the Nile began to flood soon after Sirius made its first appearance above the dawn sky. And so Sirius was really identified with being the herald of this life-bringing, so necessary, flooding of the Nile Valley. So that's for the Egyptians, Sirius was a very important object, and there are temples built during the Old Kingdom that are aligned towards the rising position of Sirius. Its rising at that time is known as a heliacal rising. Namely, it appears, the heliacal rising of an object is when it appears just ahead of the sun before dawn, and within minutes, the rising of the sun makes the sky too bright for the object to become visible anymore. And so this heliacal rising is a very, very precise event in the heavens. And this so-called heliacal rising around June in 2000 BC was this dramatic and spectacular event that was related to by the Egyptians to the rising of the Nile.
And is it the thinking that the people who perhaps made the observations and created that site that we talked about before, the place that so far is the oldest astronomical sort of site that they found, those folks then moved into Egypt later and brought with them what they knew, and that then some of the things that they built that are now famous sites of ancient Egypt, perhaps it was those folks and what they knew, and they put that into practice where they went?
That is, David, an incredibly wonderful question, because it's very, very controversial. The nomads had cows as the most important feature of their life, of their economy, and they worshipped cows. In the Nile Valley, in the Old Kingdom, the Egyptians also deified the cow. There is a cow goddess known as Hathor, who is often pictured as a woman with horns or ears of a cow, and she was responsible for the birth of the sun and the moon and the stars. People have often been puzzled that the cow was deified by the Egyptians, who were an agricultural community and didn't use a cow. It was not a major feature of their economy, like the cow had been for the nomads, for the Nubian nomads who were occupying this site in Nabta Playa that we've been talking about. So it's been a puzzle that the Egyptians had raised the cow to such a high status in their pantheon of gods. And so what we have been suggesting, the archaeologist Fred Wendorf at SMU, whom I've been working with, and I and others, that the nomads' fascination with cows was somehow transferred to the Nile Valley, and it is sort of a memory of the nomads' experience and worship of cows that has persisted in the Egyptian pantheon of gods. But there are certainly two different kinds of people, the nomads and the residents of the Nile Valley were different populations. They certainly had a completely different economy, one being nomad pastoralist, the other being agriculturalist. So there is a difference between the two communities, but there seems to have been a passing of this love of cow from the nomads to the Egyptians.
Okay, very interesting. We have some other folks to talk with. Here next is a caller in Aurora on line number 4. Hello.
Yes, hi, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I went out about 3 o'clock this morning to see if I could see the northern lights, and the sky was absolutely supreme. I saw the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper, and was that Mars next to the moon?
Was that Mars next to the moon? I'm afraid I wasn't out there. I think it was probably Mars sets in the early evening. I think it was probably Jupiter. I'm not sure myself. I was
okay. Maybe the John Dickel is going to be here in the next hour. So you can try the question again.
Yes, listening, be forewarned. You're going to have to answer this one.
The question I also had was, how far would I have had to gone to see the Northern Lights? Is there any possibility that if I would have traveled north, I would have seen it?
Well, people had reported seeing the Northern Lights in Champaign last night before the moon rose. So when the sky was dark, and it's going to be dark even longer tonight, there is the possibility of seeing the Northern Lights. They are, of course, produced by eruptions and by disturbances on the sun, and the sun is in a high state of disturbance now, and so there's probably going to be several days of Northern Lights that will be visible from here.
Oh, I'm glad I asked. I'm going to hang up, but could you tell me once more why we have the Northern Lights? What happens? Thank you.
Well, there are flares, explosions on the sun that send particles out into interplanetary space. It sends out protons and electrons, and typically they take about 24 hours to reach from the sun to the Earth. And when they hit the Earth's magnetic field, they cause disturbances, which we see as these Northern Lights.
Hmm. Our director Brian Wagner concurs that what the caller was seeing was Jupiter.
Jupiter, good.
Very good. He's on the case. We'll go next to Champaign and someone here, line number one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
I have a question regarding historical astronomy in Africa. Recently, I was in Mali visiting an area called Dogon country. And one of the things that I found about that culture was... Every 50 or so years, they have this cultural rejuvenation where they go through all the rituals, teaching the grandchildren all the new culture, all the cultures of their tribe, and they base the timing on this, which happens, as I said, every 50 or so years, off of a star, Sirius. In the Dogon culture, they say that it's actually based off of a little brother of Sirius, which I guess in modern astronomy they've identified as a white dwarf that is around Sirius. But the problem with the theory is that this culture and this way of doing things dates back 500 or so years, and I'm under the impression that white dwarf Sirius B, I think it is not visible to the naked eye. And so it's kind of a mystery. I was wondering if you had any background on this and might be able to illuminate. Were there other cultures that were aware of Sirius B, or how one might be able to see that in 500 years ago?
Wonderful, wonderful question. It's been a long-standing puzzle as to how the Dogons knew of the companion, the white dwarf companion of Sirius. Sirius was as you undoubtedly know, a star that was very important for the Dogons. It was a object of worship, similar to the way Sirius was an object of worship for the Egyptians that we'd been talking earlier, and it has been a great puzzlement that they had discovered that there was this white dwarf companion that, you're absolutely right, takes 50 years to orbit Sirius, and you're right that no one can see in Sirius without a telescope. And in fact, even with a good telescope, it's quite difficult to see the companion of Sirius, Sirius B. It's very difficult to see that with an ordinary telescope these days, because Sirius is so bright, its companion is so close to it and so faint, and one needs to have a very good telescope and very clear and steady skies. The Sirius B was discovered in the United States by a telescope maker about 1865 who was testing a new lens that he had just ground. And the word of this discovery of Sirius B sort of spread like wildfire around the world for people who were interested in such things. And it's possible that the suggestion is that this was a new addition to the mythology of the Dogons, and there may have been some unknown or unnamed forgotten Jesuit priest who had read about this discovery of Sirius B in the newspaper in France and had gone down to Mali wanted to interact with the Dogons in a very positive way and said, "Let me tell you something about your star that we just learned," and that knowledge entered the mythology of the culture without giving credit to this Jesuit. Another suggestion that's been made for the Dogons' knowledge of Sirius B, which is a little bit more off the wall, but rather fun to think about and then perhaps to dismiss, is that this is evidence that they had been visited by by aliens sometime in the past. And there's always the question of what if you were an alien, you would leave as a calling card that would persist after you. You can't leave a piece of paper because that's going to decay. But if you leave some forbidden knowledge that these people that you visited would not possibly have known on their own, that would be proof that you had visited. And so there's been the suggestion that aliens from Arcturus or from Antares or something like that visited the Dogons and said, we want to prove to Earth that we had visited you, and here's forbidden knowledge. I rather like the somewhat more pedestrian explanation that it was some Jesuit who wanted to impress the Dogons by his knowledge of Sirius. But the White Dwarf Companion is a very interesting, the White Dwarf Companion of Sirius is a really interesting star, and their cosmology is quite elaborate. In fact, they also had knowledge of a ring around Saturn, and other things which suggest that they probably had picked up information from European visitors.
I see. Well, thank you for your time.
All right, thank you. We'll continue here. There's a caller next in Urbana. It's line number 2. Hello.
Yeah, around the same latitude, the Yucatan Peninsula and the Mexico City and all that. I understand, I don't know if that means anything, but they were obviously also very heavily into astronomy. I was wondering if in particular anybody, I have two questions. I was wondering if anybody had picked up on, like the Aztecs did, if you knew anything about the Venus cycle. You know, I understand every 8 years, whatever Venus is doing in the sky, it will be doing again exactly 8 years, the same day of the month. In the future, that was the Aztecs noticed that. I was just curious if that was a widespread thing. And then I've got another question.
Well, I think is the Aztecs actually picked up that information from the Mayans, and the Mayans had, as you probably know, a number of codices. Not very many of them have remained. Most of them were burned by the Spanish, but there is a Venus codex in which they give the data of their knowledge of the phases of Venus, and you're right about that particular cycle. And they, identified Venus as a very dangerous object in the sky. You know, for us, Venus is the goddess of beauty, but for the Mayans, goddess was a harbinger of disasters and very very dangerous. And in fact, the Mayans, is going away from the Aztecs a little bit, but the Mayans had organized ritual warfare based upon the movement of Venus in the heavens. And when Venus would move into the morning sky as a morning star and would be visible as a heliacally rising object, like we were talking about Sirius, then that would be the occasion for the onset of ritual warfare between various city-states in the Yucatan Peninsula. And Armies would move out from one town, from one center to another when Venus appeared in the sky. So it was very important for everyone to observe Venus, not only the ones who were beginning to these battles, but those who were worried about being attacked. Venus also is an object which remains in the sky and is very brilliant at the time of a solar eclipse. Venus is the brightest object in the sky next to the sun and moon, and when there is an eclipse, Venus is usually close to the sun, and so when it's even though it's when it's not visible when the sun is in the, when the sun is bright, when the sun goes out and is covered over by the moon, Venus pops out. And I think the Mayans may have identified Venus as being the demon who was responsible for destroying the sun, sort of the smoking gun of the sun disappears, and there is Venus sitting up there. And there may have been some fear that Venus would come down after taking the sun out and take out the Earth. So Venus had this very dangerous aspect, and because of that, the Mayans felt it very important to watch it very carefully and hence developed this very detailed knowledge of the cycles of Venus.
It sounds like, yeah, but since you're not mentioning any, it sounds as if other places weren't quite so taken with Venus.
That's right. The Mayans were more enthralled or terrified by Venus than most, and the Babylonians had Venus tables, and so they knew the cycles of Venus also. But the Mayans are sort of notorious for the great precision of their observations of Venus.
Okay, and then oddly enough, Venus is a female name in our mythology, and which brings me to my second question, and I'll hang up. I was just curious. I was surprised to learn that a lot of the genderizing, you might call it, of objects in the sky. In that kind of genderizing, the sun was considered female, which I would think, would be more logically male, and the moon was male. Is that something true? Can you talk about that a little bit and why it might be considered something female? And I'll hang up. Thanks.
Well, I think the gender of the sun and the moon varied an awful lot from culture to culture, and some indeed have the sun is a powerful masculine symbol, and some have the sun as a female symbol. I think in general the moon is seen as more of a passive and less powerful object than the sun, but it appears both ways in different cultures.
Mm-hmm. How one of the things I'm curious about it when we talked about some of these things that have been observed and then marked. For example, the place where the sun rises in midsummer and sets in midwinter. How long do you think it would take in terms of observations for a group of people to determine these things? Could you have done that in one person's lifetime, or do you think that was the kind of thing that would stretch over many people's lifetimes and then that information would have somehow to have been passed on so that enough observations would be accumulated so people would be certain that this particular spot that they're interested in really is the spot?
Well, the nice thing about summer solstice and winter solstice is the sun sort of dwells there and hangs there for many days. And so at both winter and summer, for about 5 days, the sun doesn't move perceptibly at all. So it'd be quite easy for someone to set up a pile of a cairn of stones near the horizon point, and if it's cloudy on one day or 2 days, that there still is going to be this standstill. Solstice is a Greek word for standstill, and so the two solstices are the two times when, at the extremes of its range of motion, the sun is standing still. When I've been out working in the Southwest and exploring various astronomical sites of the Anasazi, talking to farmers who live out there, a surprising number of these farmers would have markings on their dining room walls of where the summer solstice is and the winter solstice is. So I think that's quite an easy thing to locate, and one is not at the mercy of bad weather as a result of that.
And is there also some way, I've wondered, to determine, I know this is, again, the kind of things that the people who in this field have thought about, whether in these groups of people who did these, there might have been individuals whose responsibility it was, whose work, whose job, whose calling, whatever it was, is to be the people who paid attention to those things?
Oh, very definitely, and especially in pre-literate societies, someone would have to have the responsibility for committing to memory the cycle of the sun as it would appear on the sky. So certainly in the Pueblo cultures of the Southwest, there was a tradition of a sun watcher or a sun priest who would stand at one particular place in the village or outside the village and observe the changing position of the sun on the horizon, and would have apparently memorized the particular dates of sunrise with respect to a peak or a valley on the horizon, and would come back and report that there is going to be a festival and time for a festival in 2 weeks or something like that. So the idea of an individual being responsible for the calendar is, we know, was true in many cultures.
Mm. Real quick, we'll try to get here a caller in Terre Haute in line four. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
Very quickly, I'd just like to mention how interesting the Cahokia Mounds are near St. Louis, and the Great Pyramid in Chichen Itza in Mexico. The number of steps that are there, 365, I mean, the numbers that coincide with the structure itself are really quite fascinating. And I had the privilege of being in Kenya last year and about this time, and the people there, they lead their cattle daily, and they live primarily on the blood and milk of their cattle. And when you're talking about the honoring of the cattle, I think that may be part of that ancient culture as well. I know that they seldom ever eat meat, and when they do, it's from the wild animals and seldom ever from their own cattle. Just wanted to mention those things quickly.
Yeah.
That's a very, very nice point, because these cattle burials that we found at Nabta Playa, there's a young articulated cow that had been buried, and we know from the traditions such as you discuss in of the Kenya cattle herders like the Maasai, they wouldn't sacrifice a cow unless it was very, very significant, a very important occasion. So that's why we think that the cow burial indicates this was a major religious event for them.
We must stop here because we're here at the end of the time. We just want to say to our guest, Kim Melville from University Colorado Boulder, thanks very much for talking with us.
I'm very pleased to be here.